Welcome back, everybody, to the Talking Sportsbook Show. And in this edition, I'm going to be talking to an Irish boxing legend, Carl Frampton, who has just released his brand new autobiography. We're going to be looking back at the very early days growing up in Tiger's Bay in Belfast and that journey to becoming a world champion. And if you're a boxing fan, by the way, then over the last 50-odd editions, if you want to take a look back via the website or any of the streaming providers where you access this show, you'll find some great boxing literature we've covered, and all of the major names as well, from Sugar Ray Robinson to Muhammad Ali, from Hagler and Hearns. That was one of the most recent ones. And staying with boxing, here's a clip from one of those shows. The book was called Hats, Hand Wraps and Headaches. It was a life on the inside of boxing by Paddy Fitzpatrick. And he recounts a time in this clip where he met up with Freddie Roach. It was a real chance meeting in a gym in the Channel Islands, and it led to the beginning of a great relationship, a working relationship, and a chance for him to actually go and work at the legendary Wild Card Gym. Now, it's a really good book, and it introduces people to a side of you that perhaps people weren't aware of, beginning with your struggle to deal with and overcome issues which led to you trying to take your own life, consider joining the Foreign Legion. Now, you hear many people in the fight game saying that boxing literally saved their lives. Now, would that be true for you?
Would that be true for me? I suppose if you looked at it from far enough back, you'd say, yeah. But I think anybody, you hear it in boxing, but you hear it in everything, brother. Everyone is struggling with something. And when people get into something or find something that then they're really passionate about, that because they're so passionate, all their focus comes on that, and it's easier to deal with the things they're struggling with. And sometimes the things they're struggling with can fade away because they're so focused on this new passion. So that passion for me was boxing, but I don't necessarily think it's boxing in general. I think it's just finding a passion and chasing it.
Would you say that you're a believer in fate? I mean, there's the moment in your life when it literally does change forever. You bump into Freddie Roach in a gym in the Channel Islands. He asks you if you fancy working at the Wild Card.
I believe in luck. I don't know if I believe in fate. I think that you got to have some kind of momentum in order to be able to even go forward once you find an opportunity. You know, if you're sat still, an opportunity can present itself, you don't even realize it. So you got to be moving in some kind of direction, even if it's in the wrong way. I don't necessarily believe in fate. No, I do believe I was a lucky son of a gun.
Freddie was over to prepare Steve Collins for Nigel Benn. His instruction to you was, meet me at the airport. Now, was there a part of you that as you were going up the M4 on your way from Swindon to Heathrow that was thinking, I bet he isn't going to be there?
100%. 100%. I didn't. Listen, the same as anything in my life up to that point, I thought, all right, well, I'll give it a shot. I didn't really expect him to be there at all. For what reason? I mean, what reason? I had no idea why. He can only have been made that offer. First of all, he could have only made that offer just because he wanted to try and help somebody out that he thought could do some help, I expect. Because he wouldn't have seen enough in me to think, God, this dude really knows he's boxing. Let me tell you, I have to get him over here to America with me. He didn't need me. He gave me an opportunity. Whatever reason he gave me the opportunity, I'm not sure, but I'm grateful for it.
Now, you actually moved in and lived at the Wild Card Gym, didn't you?
I had myself a little pet too after a few weeks. A mouse came in when I'd be sat there watching the TV at night. And I saw this thing out the corner of my eye one night. And I'm sat there having something to eat. I was having a pizza, I think, having a beer, having a smoke and watching some boxing on TV. And I see this thing moving. And I looked down, it was a mouse. And when I looked down, he kind of just looked at me. And he didn't dart off. So I just broke a bit of the pizza off and threw it on the floor. And he kind of scurried off of it. And then he came back and then he ate it. The next night he showed up. And he was all right until he moved his friends in, then I had to get rid of him. I ended up having to turn on him and I had to set some of those sticky jelly traps because he brought the boys back with him one night and I thought, whoa, this ain't big enough for all of us.
Now, there's a couple of moments early on which you must look back on now and smile. Tackling Alex Garcia, the heavyweight, about his unpaid gym fees being one, and the legendary phone call with James Toney.
I was thinking about this earlier today in a conversation with somebody, and I have a lot of regrets in life of, you know, big messes that I've made. But I think the regrets that stick with me most is when I have said something or reacted in a way without thinking and actually hurt somebody's feelings. Now, in that one, I reacted in a quick way and didn't think. So it could have ended up me being hurt and not my feelings physically. So Fred just goes, he owes Jim money, he ain't paid. So I was just like, hey, my man, give me a second. And then it escalated pretty quickly. But we're cool now. Me and Alex are cool. A couple of weeks after that, we got chatting and we got cool with each other. And hey, these things happen, don't they?
The James Toney phone call. It was very funny, I have to say, reading it. There's a different telephone manner in the US to how we do things in, you know, Great Britain, United Kingdom. We're all very much, hello, how can I help you? Thank you very much. Goodbye. They aren't, are they?
I answered the phone. I thought I had the American way kind of down. They don't say hello or nothing else. So I used to answer the phone same as Freddie. I'd just go wild card or boxing. And then this dude was just like, give me Freddie Roach. And I was like, all right, no problem. Who'll I tell him's calling? He said, don't worry who's calling. Just give me Freddie Roach. I said, you might as well just tell me who it is. And he goes, mother, just get Freddie Roach. So it wasn't until the third time that he called back when I said, James Toney, and then Freddie spun around. He went, no, Paddy, give me the phone, give me the phone. And then I hear Freddie going, oh, don't worry about him. There's a dude from Europe. And then when I met James and he walked through the door, I just happened to be stood in the wrong spot again. Because when you walk through the door and you look to your left, there's like just enough room to walk behind the counter. And I happened to be leaning in that flipping hole when James walks through the door. Sees Freddie, goes to walk through to Freddie, and as he goes to walk by me, I'm like, "Why, you ain't gonna say excuse me or something?" And he went, "You're that funny talking mother off the phone." I was like, "I said, oh, now I recognize you." And then Fred, he said, "You're lucky I don't put a cap in your ass." And you know, when you get to know him, he would have put a cap in your ass too. He wasn't just faking it, but. But there you go, the luck of the Irish. I got away with it.
Well, that was Paddy Fitzpatrick talking about Hans Handraps and Headaches of Life inside of boxing. Good book it is too. And you can still hear the full feature on the website or via any of the streaming providers. Now, Carl Frampton is one of the most celebrated boxers hailing from Ireland over the last 15 years or so. He's thrilled fight fans with his performances all over the world. And it culminated, of course, in the acquisition of world titles in two weight divisions. Now, of course, he is retired and that effortless charisma has managed to translate seamlessly into the many media roles that he now has, including, of course, being the face of TNT Sports boxing coverage in the studio and as a color commentator as well. Time then for the release of his autobiography, which looks back at his life at the very early beginnings on that first night he made that journey in the back of that battered old blue Mondeo with a couple of arguing adults sat in the front. The story beginning in this blue Mondeo, I'm trying to imagine you sat in the back whilst There's arguments going on with Billy and Joe in the front, and you're just 7 years old.
Yeah.
Very young.
Yeah, very young. And what I remember about that, I'm sure I was the only one, the only boxer that they were bringing up to the North Coast that night. And now, when I was doing that, the roads and stuff were very different. So from Belfast to kind of Port Rush direction where the fight was, you can do it inside an hour. But back then, it was probably an hour and a half to get up there. And yeah, it was strange. Obviously, just, you know, this kid making his first fight at 7 years old, to do that and have that much effort into me having my first fight, it was, I don't know, maybe the boys saw something in me. Maybe they saw that I was a wee bit talented and I could do something. And Joe and Billy, both my coaches. But I mean, at times I think they didn't even like each other, these guys. Like, the arguments were wild arguments all the time.
Growing up in Tigers Bay and Canning Street, your first love is football. Your teacher at school had celebrity links to a football legend.
Yeah, that's right. So David Healy, Northern Ireland's leading top goal scorer and a bit of a hero of mine, his aunt taught me in primary four. So Mrs. Healy, later found out her name was Deborah, but you never know your teacher's names, do you, when you're in primary school?
No, it's Miss.
Yeah. And I mean, I still, you know, I bump into a teacher and you still have to call them Miss or Sir, don't you? You can't call them their first name. But she was a lovely lady. But football was, I loved football. I was okay at it. I enjoyed it. I played for a couple of local clubs. And was half decent, but it was certainly, football for me was certainly more enjoyable than boxing anyway.
Your mum said that you started to ask about boxing when you were three, and it was her that sent you to the boxing club, and your dad thought you were maybe a bit too young.
Yeah. Yeah, she says that. I don't know if that's exaggerated or not, but that's what she says. So, I mean, the local boxing club was, 200 yards from the front door. So I think I was just curious, really, because I wasn't from a big family of boxers or anything like that. We always had an interest in the sport, I suppose, my dad and my uncles and certainly my two granddads as well. But I was very, very young. I mean, when I was seven, I probably looked like I was four or five as well.
The good thing about this book, right, is that you don't skirt around any of the issues. You're quite frank and you're quite happy to share a view. And I'm trying to imagine you as a young kid. You mention and talk about the troubles. And the really poignant quote I picked out here was when you said, look, growing up in Tigers Bay, you were conscious of either being, you know, Protestant or Catholic, and you think that you have to hate whoever the opposite is because everybody else did.
Yeah.
It's quite a poignant quote.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, growing up in an area where I grew up, Tigers Bay, and I suppose guys that were growing up in the neighbouring New Lodge, which was a Republican area, would have probably thought along the exact same lines. And you're influenced by anyone older on you, really, at that age. And I mean, they don't have to be a positive influence, but most of the times they're not a positive influence. But
yeah,
these are the guys that you kind of look up to just because that's what happens. And you're kind of, it's just built into you that, and you don't really know why, but these guys across the road, you know, they don't like us and we don't like them. And that's the way it is.
Even though your physique was slight, Billy McKee, he was the one that saw the athlete in you, didn't he? The reflexes, the agility, coordination, all the basic attributes. Joe was the army disciplinarian. So these were a couple, weren't they? Almost like the odd couple.
Joe was strict. He kind of, I don't know, his personality, it kind of, it got a bit easier, not easier, but he just quietened down a bit more and became a bit more sensitive, I think, the older he got. But Joe was hard work. It's just a generational thing, isn't it? And coming from, you know, the army and spending a long time in the army and his military background, he was very, very regimental. But Billy had a wee bit of a softer touch. But in saying that, I don't want to paint Billy out to be, you know, a soft guy, because he wasn't. He was quite a hard person, but just not as kind of... Not as regimental as Joe.
There's so many funny bit. You're mid serious conversation in this book, and then you drop in a quote. Yeah, at the end, I never used to shower. I used to just sit in the dressing room trying to mix and talk with the pros. What is it they used to call you?
It was Cooper. That was so Cooper, who's a friend of mine, and he's now the coach of the amateur club. He used to call me the Willy Watcher, and I think he still does from time to time. But I was only a kid. It would be a bit uncomfortable for any kid to be getting a shower beside a hairy ass man in a flipping in a communal shower room. But yeah, that's I used to go in and enjoy the chat.
Back in the ring. So you begin as a southpaw, because basically, as you said, you were right-handed and you just thought that was the thing to do. I was surprised that they didn't immediately, they saw you doing this, say, right, come over here. This isn't the way you do it.
Yeah, no, it was, they kind of switched me a bit, and it took a while for me to kind of get used to it. I think when you just start boxing, it seems a little bit unnatural to lead with your weaker hand and your weaker foot, really. So I think most kids probably go through the same thing, that their strong hand is the hand that they lead with. And they changed my stance. But I'm kind of hoping that, knowing the issues that I had with southpaws kind of coming through the amateurs, I was... You know, it might have been better if they kept me a southpaw.
Again, more pressure on you as a kid in the amateurs. I mean, the goal for some, as you say, to put on the green shirt, represent Ireland. You know, you're working together. Most of the big boxing clubs were Catholic clubs, and you say at the time, listen, you know, this might be progressive, but you're always aware of who you are. Mm.
Yeah, look, I was always aware of who I am and what I am. Actually, I mean, I'm a unionist, but I never ever wanted to represent GB, because that wasn't the way it was. You know, boxing was an All-Ireland sport, as is the rugby. And, you know, like the unionists who represent Ireland as rugby players, I was happy to do the same in the boxing ring. So I was very, very proud to represent Ireland. And you know, I remember actually when I got my first call up, it was against England, in Ireland versus England schoolboys, a fight that I actually lost. But I remember, just
was this in Ipswich?
It was in Ipswich, that's right. Yeah. But I just remember feeling the pride of, you know, representing my country.
20 years ago, this is 2003, your first trip away with the cadets in Bucharest. Mm. You're 60. I mean, this must have been an amazing time for you. You know, you're away from home, and, you know, you're competing, and your first fight against a Tunisian that was old enough to be my dad.
Yeah, he didn't look like he was 16, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, that was magic. I was someone who didn't really have the privilege of going on foreign holidays growing up. So to get the chance to go to a place like Romania, it's not the typical holiday resort really for people, but Bucharest was a lovely city. And I just enjoyed the whole experience, really, being with Team Ireland. And pride is probably the emotion that I was feeling there.
Yeah, you had a good time at night, by the way, as well, didn't you? Until the team manager came in.
Yeah,
that's strip club.
We were only kids, but that, I mean, this is what
happens, that's what you do, isn't it?
It's what you do, and you try to show off. And to be honest, I was going along with the boys. I was probably a bit more uncomfortable than anyone else that was there, but that's boys being boys, isn't it? And you kind of try and you just follow suit, don't you, and do what everyone else is doing.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You did quite well in your school, in your exams as well. Your GCSEs, you got good grades. And why did you decide then that you were going to enrol at university?
Well, I done okay at GCSE level. I didn't do great, and then I went to a tech as well after school, or after I'd left. I'd done my 5 years of high school, and then I was planning on doing A-levels. I'd done 1 year of them. Obviously, they're 2 years, and I just thought, I'm going to go to tech here and pack it in. All my mates had kind of left school, and I was walking around school on my own for a lot of the time. Went to tech, and then thought I would go and do a sports science degree in university. And the reason for that was because I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I knew I wanted to be a boxer or a sportsman of some sort. So, you know, that was probably the course that fitted me best, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It was memorable for one other thing as well, wasn't it? Because you actually met the girl.
Yeah, well, I didn't meet her. I saw her.
At the bus stop.
Yeah, at the bus stop. Yeah, I didn't introduce myself or anything, but we'd been kind of talking. I used to hate saying this, talking online, because it almost sounds a bit sad, doesn't it? That's how you met my now wife. But, I mean, that's how everybody meets each other these days. So
yeah,
maybe
true.
We were trendsetters. I don't know.
How impressed was she? I still can't believe the story you tell about taking her out on a date to Spoons.
Yeah,
you ordered the steak and chips for yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't know what to do. It was a new thing for me to have a girl out on a date. And as dates go, it probably wasn't the best one for me, you know, Witherspoons and a couple of bars and a nightclub and me eating a steak and chips while I did offer in fairness, but apparently when a lady says no, I don't want anything, they do want something. Yeah, so I didn't know at that stage that that's what that meant.
Always not far away at this time, there was this decision that was looming, whether or not you give up playing football and concentrate firmly on boxing.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
how difficult was that? I mean, because you were obviously better than just average at football.
I don't know. I was maybe slightly better than average, maybe. But I'd say, depending on who you speak to, some people would say, yeah, he's bang average, but
They used to call you Roberto Carlos, didn't they?
Well, someone did, but that was called the name was Carl, really. That wasn't really like, I don't think I resembled Roberto Carlos really when I was playing. Just had a similar name. But I knew it was going to be at some point, I was going to have to make a decision as to which sport that I was going to want to try and take seriously. And I mean, it was an easy decision, really, in the end. I don't think it was a difficult one. Although I did miss playing football, I knew I was doing the right thing and choosing boxing.
Irish National Championships, first attempt, you win it. I mean, this is a significant achievement.
Yeah, as a senior, yeah, I had a couple of cracks. What's strange with me is you get a lot of guys who win underage tournaments and, you know, schoolboys and juniors and intermediates and stuff. And I didn't do that well, really, at them sort of levels. But my first time in the Irish Senior Championships, I won them. I was Irish Senior Champion. I'd just turned 18 when the final came around. So I was only 17 when the championship started. And I was able to call myself, you know, the Senior Champion of Ireland, which was a huge moment for me.
And then, I mean, you experience the success and then you experience something else, because you talk about your biggest regret not getting to the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne after that surprise loss to Rand Lindberg in Ulster Hall.
Yeah, that was a shame. I mean, I was obviously representing Ireland. I mean, I was happy to do so, and I was very, very proud to do so. But Northern Ireland, to represent Northern Ireland, you only get the chance to do that at the Commonwealth Games. We officially don't really have a Northern Ireland team unless it's a Commonwealth Games year. So,
yeah,
I wanted to represent Northern Ireland, and I wanted to do that at the Commonwealth Games and hopefully medal, as so many great fighters have done before me. And it just wasn't to be. I mean, I was the number one in the Four Nations at the time. Going into that fight with Rand Lindberg, I'd just beat a Welsh kid in the multi-nations on the 20-point rule. I was literally 20 points up at the start of the third round, 20-0. And if I didn't enter, and I didn't enter the Ulster Championships and didn't fight Rand Lindberg, they'd have probably selected me as the number one. So, I maybe got that.
It's interesting right, because as you're getting closer to becoming pro, you're taking on issues, and you said that you faded often in the second half of fights. It was rare that you got a comeback victory. So if you were behind, there was little chance of coming back. And this is, you're looking at the whole life of a professional here, because you realize, listen, diet, this is the major culprit here. So less trips to Spoons.
Yeah, pretty much. I understood that, and I tried to think about it rationally, and I why is this happening to me? And it was a point where I just kind of decided I needed to take things serious if I wanted to do what I want to do and become successful in boxing. And as an amateur, that was one of my issues, my tank, my engine, and the only reason for that was because of my lack of kind of taking it serious.
Yeah. Then, I mean, the big moment was when, and I quote from the book, Barry sold you the professional dream at 22, and you've got the name, great name, the Jackal, and you get the six fight, six venue deal with Matchroom. And the 12th of June 2009, I mean, it seems like yesterday that you only just made your debut against Sandor Zinaval, who was also a southpaw. And this, I can imagine the build up, and you're so excited and everything, and you can't wait to get in there. But you couldn't get in the ring, really, could you? Because you'd forgotten the gum shield.
I forgot my gum shield, yeah. So I think McGuigan actually rushed back quickly to the hotel to collect the gum shield. And I remember being really nervous. A couple of reasons going into that fight. Obviously, it was my professional debut. But warming up for the fight was the first time I ever had a professional glove on my hand. And I remember just kind of feeling the gloves and feeling my knuckle through them and thinking, like, these are insane. They're definitely not as safe as amateur gloves. And also the fact that this kid was a southpaw, and I wasn't really great with southpaws up until that point. I'd lost to a few bang average southpaws as an amateur. It took me a while to work them out. And so all these things were going around in my head, but I mean, it turned out to be a reasonably easy fight.
Your seventh fight, you're headlining at Ulster Hall, and you're selling out this venue, which again is a pretty amazing feat. So, I mean, your reputation was building very, very quickly, and you're up against a guy called Yuri Voronin, and you're even attracting Hollywood A-listers who are popping up.
Yeah, well, look, and in fairness, I have to, it's one of the things I do have to thank Barry McGuigan for, because the limelight and the attention I was getting, really, because I hadn't really done much up until that point, but it was because of who my manager was, and people seen these similarities with myself and Barry was singing my praises everywhere. And I can imagine a lot of fighters who had done a lot more than me. At that time, guys like Paul McCluskey and Martin Rogan were maybe a bit pissed off that this new upstart is getting all the attention because of who his manager is. But the Daniel Day-Lewis was at ringside for that fight against Warren. But I mean, again, that was Barry's connection. He worked with Daniel in the film The Boxer. But it was an honor to have him there. I mean, that's a superstar.
Yeah, just a bit. How much more pressure was there on you for that first slot when the show on primetime TV with Robbie Turley? Does it add even more pressure for you to perform because you know it's on the TV?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's one of the reasons why it wasn't such a great performance. I had a good slot. I was chief support on Sky Sports to, was it Gavin Reese, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah. So it was a decent slot, but I just maybe was trying too much to impress, and I made the fight a little bit more difficult than I should have. But in saying that, Robbie Turley wasn't a bad fighter. He was tough. He was at home. It was never going to be an easy fight, but I think there was maybe just a little bit too much going on at that time, and I suppose these are sort of the experiences you need coming up, and you gain experience from them, but certainly I'd almost tried too hard in that fight to look good, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And it didn't really work out.
The big fight is Kiko Martinez, but it's cancelled twice. His dad had his leg amputated, then there was the injury. Yeah. But again, the quality of the opposition that you're being put in against is pretty high end. You know, so you get Steve Molitor back in September 2012, I think it was. This is at the SSE, which is the biggest arena. You're right in the spotlight. I mean, this guy, although in the twilight of his career, was the real deal. Two-time former champion. Yeah. You know, this guy knew his way around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's another thing that I have to give Barry McGuigan credit for. He knows boxing inside out, really. And in terms of matchmaking and picking opponents at the right time, he's very, very good at that. And Steve Molitor, I'm kind of on an upward trajectory in my career, and Molitor's going the opposite way, but he'd been at a higher peak than I had been. So it was probably a risk as well, but it paid off. You know, I looked really good in that fight, and that was kind of one of the ones where people started to take notice. I think actually I may have went into the top 10 super bantamweights in the Ring magazine after that win.
Amazing atmosphere, by the way, as well.
Yeah, unbelievable. Unbelievable atmosphere.
And finally, you get Kiko in the February for the European title. I mean, this does look funny now, by the way, the thing at the press conference. Your dad gave you the line, didn't he? Kiko's hair is like his title. He's losing both.
That was my dad fed me that one. But I mean, I'd said that at the press conference, and you know, it's probably, you know, if you're a balding man, it's probably something that's going to annoy you a little bit. But Kiko lost his rag. He absolutely lost the head. And it was all fun and games. But even that Kiko fight, although it was scheduled to take place a few fights before it on two different occasions, it was probably a blessing in disguise that it didn't happen when it was originally meant to, because may have been a little bit green still.
Yeah.
For Kiko Martinez, if I'm being honest, but you know, when I had to fight him, I think it was my 16th fight, maybe something like that, for the European title, I was ready to do a job.
And you did do a job. And Kiko, though, after that, amazingly had one comeback win, and then beat Jonathan Romero for the IBF title. Which, I mean, it just shows you how strange this sport is. See, and you've got to wait. It's to 2014, isn't it? September 2014 for the world title. And this venue was the Titanic Quarter in Belfast, because you're running out of places to go because so many people want to watch you.
Yeah, look, the Odyssey at that stage, for, you know, for someone who's selling out the Odyssey in for IBF Intercontinental titles against Steve Molitor. You want a bigger venue than that for a world title, a proper world title. The problem is that the Odyssey is the biggest venue in Belfast, so we had to build one. I think it was the former First Minister's idea, actually, Peter Robinson, that suggested it to Barry. Let's build a purpose-built stadium. 16,000 people there in the Titanic Quarter. It was a magic night and a really, really like iconic setting for myself. That from the ring you could kind of see up towards Tigers Bay. You could almost see it in the distance. Belfast is very, very famous for having built the Titanic. It was just like an ideal setting.
Yeah.
But in saying that, there was a lot of pressure on me getting into that fight because I'd already beaten Kiko and people had just expected me to do it again as if it was just, you know, he just has to show up. And I remember how tough the first fight was. So it was a strange feeling getting into that fight.
There was a bit going on, wasn't there? I mean, there was the headbutt, the hitting on the back of the head. I mean, it got rough.
Yeah, it was a rough fight, but yeah, it did. So I'd kind of hit him with a little cheeky nudge on my head with my head, purposely. May I add, I don't normally do that. I genuinely have never done it before or after. But at that time, I wasn't really the biggest fan of Kiko, and I'd hit him a little nudge, and it's cut him. And then later on the next round that Steve Gray, the referee, after Kiko threw me to the ground, he punched me in the back of the head when I'm on all fours, and Steve Gray speaks to us both. He says something to Kiko, I'm not sure what, but he comes over to me and says, look, I've let you away with a blatant headbutt. I'm going to let him away with that. So first for, I suppose.
After Abelos, you got three of the next four trips outside of Europe. El Paso, Brooklyn and Vegas, the heat and the humidity when you got to El Paso in the meeting with Gonzalez. I mean, this hit you, didn't it? I mean, this is like, you know, something that you've never experienced before, this level of, you know, air quality, heat and humidity.
Yeah, it was insane. Honestly, the heat was very, very hot. Extremely hot. Like uncomfortably hot to walk 200 yards across the road from the hotel to the local restaurant. It was that type of heat. But still, I was extremely confident that I was going to be able to, you know, do a number on this guy. I saw Gonzalez walking around the hotel, and to me, I was looking at him thinking like, he was taller than me, but he was very, very skinny. I remember just thinking, I'm going to go right through you. But it didn't really work out that way.
He had you down twice. That was the worst first. Was it the worst first round you'd ever had?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was a horrible first round. You know, if you want to combine all my fights together, I'd never even had If you put all my worst rounds together, they weren't worse than that first round that I had in Texas. And it was a shock to me. It was a strange feeling that it had never happened before in a fight. And, I had to get back off my... I remember just going to, you know, knowing, sitting at the end, on the stool at the end of the first round, knowing that, I'm in one round in and I'm 3 points down. Like, this is going to be difficult. But I stuck to my boxing and... I ended up winning pretty comfortably on the scorecards in the end, but that was a shock to me. But I showed myself something that night that although you may think you can fight through a bit of adversity, you need to have it in your career to actually do it, and that was the first moment for me.
Leo Santa Cruz, I mean, you done quick. Leo Santa Cruz was again another really dangerous fighter, volume puncher, throws. Yeah. Regularly, 100 punches around, non-stop action. You nearly had him down in the second round.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the plan going into the fight was to just to make him respect me, because he obviously is a volume puncher. He throws a lot of punches, and I don't want him to be able to think like he can just walk through me and continue to punt. So I wanted to hurt him early on and let him feel my power. So So he's not going to be as aggressive in the fight. And you know, I nailed him in the second round, and if the ropes weren't there, he probably would have been on his backside. But so it wasn't officially scored as a knockdown or anything, but it was a good shot, and that was kind of, it was important to do that early in the fight, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you dominated pretty much against this guy who was a three weight champion. Again, another hugely impressive career. But that final round in that fight, I mean, if he was going down, he's going down swinging, throwing. He threw 114 punches.
Yeah, in the last round. Yeah, the 12th round of a 12-round fight. I mean, yeah, it's unbelievable. And it's just, you know, a credit to his fitness levels and his toughness and his will to win. It was an incredible fight, really, really good fight. And, you know, when you win the fight, when you're not really expected to win it, I was a massive underdog getting into that fight. It's going to be hard to ever relive anything close to that. That feeling was, I mean, it was insane, absolutely insane. Just pure ecstasy and joy that I've done something that nobody thought I could do.
Big celebration at Annie Moore's as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, we went to Annie Moore's, which is an Irish pub in Manhattan, the next day, and we all had a bit of a gargle and
like
a good night, really.
Bit of a gargle.
Yeah.
You are a major, major up there with all of the best. Everybody wants a piece of you, and you finally get to experience the boxing mecca that is Las Vegas in all of its gaudy splendor.
Yeah, that was amazing. Unbelievable. Like, just walking down the strip and there was,
your face on the billboard.
Yeah, on billboards and lit up on the side of the MGM next to David Copperfield and what do you call the country singer?
Oh,
I can't remember.
God, no, can't remember.
Was it Shania Twain?
Oh, Shania
like
Twain.
That, maybe. it was amazing.
Did any of this detract? I mean, I know you had some issues with the training camp, but then when you move into the MGM and you're in the sky loft and you've got, you know, you're on two floors and a butler and a steam room. Are these distractions? Yeah. I mean, can you feel yourself getting distracted, and is it more difficult to focus, to remain focused on the job?
No, I don't think I was distracted, and I don't think it was more difficult to remain focused. I was always focused and, you know, in my head, I was going to win that fight. I knew it wasn't going to be easy, and obviously it wasn't because I lost, but they weren't distractions to me. I almost felt like, I don't know, a bit of a dream and a bit of a blur at times because, I don't know, it all feels a bit too much, you know what I mean? The butler, I mean, who needs a butler? No one needs a butler. and it was strange.
There was no car to pick you. I mean, this was incredible. This is like something out of a crime caper movie. You're waiting outside the hotel to get to the venue to the fight, and you haven't got a car, and you've got to run there. So there's you crossing six lane highways, running over to make sure you get to the venue.
Yeah, it was strange. So we stayed in the MGM, and the fight was in the MGM. But to get into the fighter's entrance, rather than walk through the massive hotel, what it is, you have to kind of drive from an exit and drive around to the part where you're meant to be. And for some reason, there was no car for me. And myself, my wife, Christine, and Jake McGuigan, I think it was me that suggested it, you know, with my backpack on. Like, we can't wait here. We need to get over there. Do you want to just walk or run? Walking was the idea, but, you know, trying to walk across the roads in Vegas that are maybe three lanes either side or maybe four lanes either side, we ended up having to run across, get in the back door, and, you know, the security person there was kind of like, what are you doing here? Who are you? You're in the wrong place. And I kind of had to tell her that, you know, the lanyard that she's wearing around her neck is a picture of me on it. I'm fighting tonight. So she was surprised that I arrived the way I did, but I mean, I had to get there some way.
You weren't given at any time in your career what looked like an easy fight to come back with. You had Gauthier, you had Nonita Donaire, Jackson, which was an amazing experience for you as well, because that was at Windsor Park for the first time. What was it like walking out there? You had Deontay Wilder in the dressing room coming in. You had David Healy as part of your ring walk. And then you had the amazing ring walk song, didn't you? Simple Minds, Belfast Child.
Yeah, it was amazing. Almost like a carnival atmosphere. There was a lot of rain that night as well, but it didn't seem to dampen anyone's spirits. And I remember Jimmy Moore actually just saying, on the ring walk, he kind of whispered in my ear, just, you know, soak this in now, remember it, and let's switch on once you get to the ring. So I think that was wise advice. I remember just looking around going, this is unbelievable. And it's not something I always wanted to do, because who does, growing up, think that they can fill out the National Football Stadium, the boxer? But as my career progressed and I got more popularity, then it was something that I started to genuinely think about and think it was a possibility of doing. But when actually I got the chance to fight at Windsor Park, I mean, it was unbelievable.
Josh Warrington, you thought you were a favourite here. Your quote in the book, I thought I'd be okay taking one from him until I did.
Yeah, Josh, up until that point, there was nothing in his record to suggest he was a puncher. He maybe had like 30 wins, something like that anyway, and only 6 knockouts, something like that. Very, very low knockout ratio. I've been in with big punchers before. I've sparred big guys. I'd regularly spar welterweights and even sometimes like middleweights and be okay and never really be hurt that much. So I thought that although I was expecting a tough fight, because I know Josh is very, very fit and strong, physically strong and tough, I didn't think he could hurt me. And yeah, he hurt me probably inside the first minute in the fight, and I'd never felt anything like
it. You were injured as well, as in you picked up an injury in the weeks before, hadn't you, which affected you in the middle of rounds. You had a muscle or leg problem?
Yeah, a little bit. There was something. So we done this thing. Me and both Josh were we were sponsored by 32 Red. He's a Leeds fan. I was a Rangers fan. So he went to Leeds and done. We were doing these volleys to see who could do the most volleys and hit a target. And I mean, I was volleying a ball. People were throwing a ball at me, and I was volleying it for maybe over a hundred times, and it tore a little muscle in the front of my leg, down kind of in between like my foot and my shin, sort of affected me running. But that was okay. By the time the fight came around, that was fine. Like I'd recovered from that. But in the fight, and I think it was when there was one of the barrages going on, and I was on the back foot trying to fight back. I've took a knee from Josh Warrington in the quad. And it was pretty sore. It was almost like a dead leg. Obviously it was accidental, but I couldn't really get up on my toes either. It made things even harder for me.
Could you be, I mean, you'd suffered the odd setback, very few setbacks before, but Top Rank waded in with this deal. You know, when retirement is maybe on the horizon, it's beginning to, you may be having that discussion with yourself, do I want to do it anymore? But then $1 million for 6 fights going up every time, the purse going up every time. I mean, that was just, you couldn't turn that down. I mean,
of course not. It was unbelievable. And to be honest, I think that 6 fights was probably more than I wanted to have, but I didn't want to finish my career. I actually, after the Warrington fight, for about a week in my head, I was retired. But I started to try and think about it, and the preparation in the camp was good, apart from the injury. But I had sparred well when I was able to spar, and I just thought that it was a case of me getting it wrong rather than me being over the hill. So when this offer was made by Top Rank, and the opportunity to move up to super featherweight and try and become a world champion. Again, it was too good to turn down. But I mean, I was only hoping to have maybe in our two, three fights, something like that. I was never ever planning on filling out the full 6-fight contract.
You'd never really suffered injury, serious injury or niggling injuries that much throughout the course of your career. How much of a frustration was it for you when suddenly, you know, you're breaking bones and it's postponing fights, and then although the knocking over of a 6 kilo or 60 kilo statue in the reception of a hotel by Jamie wasn't ideal.
No, it wasn't ideal at all. It was a disaster actually. And you know, we were in Philadelphia getting ready for it was my comeback fight against Warrington, the first fight in the top rank deal, and a pillar got knocked over and broke my hand on a table, which wasn't ideal. And I think we were 5 days out from the fight at this stage as well, and people had already paid to travel to Philadelphia. I felt horrible about that, and the fact that I'd been away from my wife and kids in America for like 3 weeks already, it all just felt like a waste. And then, you know, once your hand's broke, it's never really right, completely right again. And as I started to get older, I was just picking up more and more, just wear and tear. And that's what happens when you're in a sport like boxing and you've been involved in it for so long that the things start to fall apart at some point. And that's what started to happen to me.
And you did get a couple of victories there. You fought in Vegas again at the Cosmopolitan. You beat Tyler McCree, which again was something of a bizarre event because you'd broken that bone again and were literally, and they wouldn't allow you a cortisone injection.
Yeah, that was strange. We'd actually, so the doctor who was looking after me, a guy called Mike Hayton in Belfast, he'd done scans and said, look, it's not completely healed as it would like, but if you wear big gloves, you know, big protective gloves, and make sure your hands are wrapped really well, then, you know, it probably will be okay. So I took his advice and it was okay up until the very last bar I got into the fight. And because I hadn't sparred that much, I wanted to do a little bit more than I should have. So Jamie had said, look, just do a sharpener. All you need is 4 rounds here. And I'd finished 4 rounds. Ham was fine. And I says, look, can we do an R2? He reluctantly agreed. And then the 5th round, I broke my hand again. So it was broken going into that fight with Tyler McCreary, which wasn't ideal. But Mike Hayton had contacted the Nevada State Athletic Commission asking what, didn't say my name or anything, but just saying, what is the procedure and how much cortisone can you put into a hand or any part of the body if there's an injury? And they give them an explanation, says you can put this much in, whatever it was. But then when I asked for it and inquired to have my hand injected, they refused it. And I just had to put a topical ointment on it, which is literally no use at all. Mm-hmm. So I went into that fight with a broken hand and then subsequently actually broke my right hand in round 7 of the fight as well. So I finished the fight with 2 broken hands.
Lastly, last thing I want to mention, because this does take over a section of the book, but we won't go into massive detail. How sad was it for you the way everything ended up with Barry?
Yeah, look, it was so sad. I mean, I think it's always worse when it's people you love and trust. And then that's the feelings I had for these people. You know, I had Shane and Jake McGuigan as groomsmen at my wedding. And I often talked about Barry as a father figure. And even, you know, thinking back now, that's probably a bit disrespectful to my own dad, who, you know, you can say that if you don't have a dad, but my dad's around still, and he's, you know, my dad's my mate. So, but that's how fond of these people that I were. But yeah, it was a shame, such a shame. And to be honest, when it happened, it took me a while to get over it, and I was upset. I was very sad. I was I was bitter. I was angry as well.
And for them to take this all the way to the 11th hour in a court case and have everything laid bare. I mean, I was looking at it thinking, if I'd have been their legal advisors, why would I have wanted to go in and put myself in the dock and answer that's, questions that I couldn't answer?
That's what I thought the whole way throughout the court process. Like, what's going on here? But I think that's obviously it's a big part of the book, the legal stuff. But there was 19 days of court before any sort of settlement was talked about or agreed. So anything in them 19 days can be written down and spoke about in the book. And
I was getting a bit concerned at the fact that you were shopping quite regularly at the Beach Bunny swimwear shack.
Yeah, there was some of the expenses were a bit mad. There was coming out of fake purses and stuff. Actually, a couple of my mates are saying, "Are you sure you're not just a cross-dresser?" But I promise you, I'm not.
Well, it's been brilliant, Carl, because it's a great book. Because, like I said, you've not skirted or skated around any of the issues that people might think, you know, difficult to put into the public domain. So congratulations! It's a great book.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Thanks very much.
And that was Carl Frampton talking to me about his brand new book, The Autobiography. It is out now. It is available from all of the usual outlets. And that is it for this edition of the show. Don't forget, you can catch up with all of the previous editions via the website at www.talkingsportsbooks.com, or you can find it on any of the major streaming providers. Thank you very much for joining us again, and I look forward to having your company again very soon. For the moment, though, from me, Tim Capel, bye-bye for now.